Well, welcome back. This next session is really an overview on Argentine wines in the U.S. market. And we've brought some people that have been literally in the trenches of the U.S. market selling Argentine wines on a retail basis, that have been in there banging their heads against the wall in some cases, some success as well. But just to kind of tell you a little bit of how it's like out there, what people are buying, what people like. Just to give you an overview, some context for if you think about what people might want to do in terms of buying wines, or even in terms of what kind of wines they might like, and how this a little bit perhaps of the how the style of Argentine wine is evolving, and where we kind of want to be from a positioning perspective. So we have Paul Leary, vineyard owner. They distribute our Recuerdo wines, in addition to an extensive portfolio of their wines from Blackbird Vineyard up in Napa, where we'll be visiting one of their tasting rooms at Maison Rie on Saturday. Ed Lerman from Vine Connections, who has probably the most extensive portfolio of Argentine wines selling here in the U.S. We all know Santiago. And Nora Favalucas, who is with the Wines of Argentina. So they're the trade group that represents most of the major wineries in Argentina. So she's going to start and give us a little context for this discussion, and then we'll probably also, Pablo will probably jump in it as well, as he's been in the trenches also. So
thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Before we start, I want to share with you that in 1986, I did my first of four business trips to America, representing Navarro Correas, the first premium boutique winery from Argentina. At that time, I did Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, East Coast, ending in Miami, 45-day trips, four business trips like this. And to find an Argentine wine in 1986, I had to go to the store, back of the store, lower shelf, take a Kleenex to dust the bottle. And if it was a white wine, probably was a 10 vintage, the vintage was 10 years older. So I think a lot of water has gone through the bridge. In 1988, Trapiche sent me to work in the States as East Coast sales manager. And in 1990, I moved to Billington. I introduced Catena to Billington, and we launched Catena. So my experience is not only as the U.S. representative for Wines of Argentina in charge of the branding of Wines of Argentina for the past seven years, but also I was in the trenches before they were trenches.
She was digging the trenches.
Thank you for digging those trenches.
Yeah. And today I have not only survived, but also I'm alive, and you cannot understand the pleasure that I have today to be here and see you all. And this is a new time. For the past 7 years, I've been watching you guys from afar, from New York. That's where I live. And I have seen you, and I said, well, let me see. I wanted to see what you were doing and how was it going. And I'm in awe of what you have built, not only of the idea, the concept, but also what you have done. And I'm in awe of you, all these Argentine passionate people. So without further ado, let's talk about, they asked me to do stats, and I know that's very colorful and dramatic, so I'm going to to give a little context. I added some slides on the U.S. market so as to understand how it works. The U.S. is, to my understanding, the best wine market in the world. I have worked for 2 years in Europe, from 2002 to 2004, having the UK market as mine. I hated it deeply. Why? Because the US is the only market where you can build a brand. The other markets is just sell by price. So in the US, we have an adult population that keeps on growing, 228 million. And the gallons per adult also. So for the past 19 years, the U.S. is the only country that produces wine and that consumes wine, and the consumption of wine is growing steadily. Of those 228 million adults, we have 100 that are wine drinkers. Mind you, it's a lot of people. Mind you, in China today, we have also 100. But I want to make the difference. these 100 are different than the Chinese 100. 78 non-wine drinkers that will come, and 50, and 50 beer and liquor. Transformation since 1994 of 34% core, 56% marginal. Today we have 57 core, 43 marginal. Core means that they drink at least once a week, minimum. And for those of you who are producing wines and want to sell your wines in the U.S., this is the category of the millennials that are mostly your target audience. When we look at the 67 plus and the baby boomers, this category of these generations, they are much more used to drink domestic wines. The millennial and the younger generations, they are much more open to funny names, to explore new countries and to drink, and they're much more versatile. And the millennials are definitely responsible for the growth of Malbec and Argentina. Consumers by gender, 55% women, 45% men, is changing thanks to the millennial. The millennial males are going out and are buying their own wines, not only their wives. A little bit of numbers. This is important to understand that these statistics are compared January, July 2012 through with January, July 2013. And we can say here in volume that Argentina has had a growth of 7%. Compared to the other countries. Then, in value, Argentina has had a growth of 12%. These numbers will shift when we do the year, when we see January through December, because I'm sure that if we go back to volume, if we go back to volume, Chile is in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7th place, but I'm sure it will jump here, but they ship probably too much wine in December 2012, mm-hmm. and that's why their numbers are low. Something key on understanding imported wines is that wines that have 14% plus alcohol, they pay a different tax. That's why they're not included in the overall table wines. So when I look at this bottle dessert and table wines over 14, and I see a growth of 13% for Argentina, I said, I don't think it's the Torontés dessert wine that is making this difference. So it has to be higher end Argentine wines, mm-hmm. wines that are produced with a lot of alcohol, but also power. These are premium, super premium wines. So in this category, over 14% of alcohol, we see Argentina a growth of 13%. Bulk wine in exports. I know this is not an issue that is dear to your hearts because you are not in the bulk wine business, but it's important to understand that Argentina, because of Cristina and other issues in Argentina, it has been very difficult for the producers to sustain the growth and the sales of their lower-end wines. Because of that, they chose the alternate route of sending bulk wine that is bottled here in the U.S. With that, the numbers and the category of Argentine wines doesn't count the bulk wines. And because of that, it could seem that the Argentine category growth is very small, but when you add the millions of liters that were exported with bulk, actually the Argentine category continues to grow. And this is the growth. Can you see the shift? Many big brands today, producers like Zuccardi, I'm sure Catena, they're sending in bulk wine, wines that sell for under $10 to replace. And we can see that Chile also, all these countries, and the U.S. has become one of the largest importers of bulk wine in the world.
There's also a tremendous amount of Moscato in that number.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is another way of looking at the statistics. These were the previous one were the Department of Commerce, but also we have Nielsen. Nielsen does the statistics by scanning the SKUs in the machines in the retail shops. In this case, when it says food, drug, and liquor stores, because it's also food store, drug stores, like Walgreens, and liquor stores, because it includes retail sales in major markets like New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. And here we can see, on a four-week period ending on August 17, that in volume, Argentina has grown 7.5, and in dollars, 10.2. The 52 weeks ending on August 17, volume 6.3, and dollars 12.6. Retail wine numbers in the U.S. are extremely strong, $13 billion of dollars. And we cannot discount the importance of Walgreens, the Costco's, in terms of moving a lot of volume. I had to talk about Malbec. So the same report on Malbec shows that for the four-week period ending on August 17, the volume of Malbec sales increased 12%, and in dollars, 11.5. The same on 52 weeks, volume 13, and dollars 12.7. What is interesting to observe is that we are in America. Americans are price conscientious. That means, oh, did I pronounce it well? I'm sure. There is an accent somewhere there. So it is interesting to see how Argentine wines, they are increasing in sales, but also they're increasing in value. That means that producers from Argentina can export at higher prices, and that doesn't affect the volume. And like Chile, that they position themselves in under the $10 or $15, and it's very hard for them to get sales on the higher end wines. Of the top 15 varietals exported, definitely Malbec is the star, at an average FOB price from Argentina at $39.15. Second is Cabernet Sauvignon at $40.89. And generic reds, these are blends. I'm sure that for the statistics they say generic reds, but this is blends, $52. There is room for Chardonnay and Torontés. I don't see Cabernet Franc, but guys, you have to get on board. Imported table shipments by color. You can see that 44% of all the wines from Italy exported to the U.S. are red, 60 from Australia, 65 from France, 68 from Chile, and 64 from Argentina. So these are, that means that Argentine exports are heavy on reds. When we first started to sell Argentine wines in 86, 88, 90, when we first launched Catena, it was Cabernet Sauvignon. We didn't even think about Malbec. We probably think now, well, everything is Malbec. But at the beginning, and the first wine that Catena sold and Catena brought was Cabernet Sauvignon. Thank you for it. So, definitely Malbec is the millennial generation wine of choice. It gave Argentina a unique identity. When you say Shiraz, you can think of Australia, but everybody in the world does Shiraz, Syrah, etc. When you think of Zinfandel, you think of America. But when you say Pinot Noir, that was so famous a few years ago, Pinot Noir everybody makes. Merlot, everybody makes Merlot. But Malbec from Argentina really gave definition, and everybody when you say Malbec, they think Argentina. So we own the Malbec category, in spite of the French that they want to get with us at Vinexpo. I have a funny story. I've been a huge fan of Vinexpo. I go since 89, and and I'm a huge Francophile. I want to put that as mine, so you understand where I'm coming from. The area for South America and New World wines at Vinexpo is always the last one, the one who has the poorest air conditioning, and isn't it like that? So it's horrible. And in the past few years, it's always hard because they leave the doors open, we are dying with heat, we don't have enough light, etc., etc. the pass to Vinex was at the back, all the way at the back, next to Argentina, the Malbec from France region. So they moved from their beautiful air conditioning area where all the French are to come and suffer with us in our section. So that shows that, as the Texans say, we make that. There are people that make dust and people that eat dust. So. I love the Texans. critical success factors for sommeliers and for the trade in the U.S. is not price, is not quality, is price-quality ratio. So you can sell, and Argentina has proven it. We can sell, and Santiago, you can say it, you can sell a very expensive 100 plus, 200 plus dollar wine, but if the quality is there, people will buy it. It can sell at all price levels. Argentina is one of the few wine, new world wine countries, and the only one in South America that can sell at all price levels, from 8 to 30, from 30 to 100, and we always get buyers, because of the great price-quality ratio. This is a chart of Malbec exports to the U.S. from 2004 to 2012. And you can see that although this, the share today is 67.3 of the exports, but it has had a growth that started very strong and continues very strong, 2.8. All this power, the PowerPoint, Michael, you will have it, so you can give it.
Pointing out one thing in that column there, one of the reasons that Malbec has done so well is because of the Great Recession, truly, because I'm, you know, from Napa, 17 years in Napa, and there was a survey that went out in 2009 that said, okay, now that you're not drinking $100 Napa wines anymore as often, what are you drinking? And it was $50 Napa wines, $50 Washington Reds, or $20 Malbecs, and $20 Malbecs was at the top, mm-hmm. next to Napa. But I truly believe that Malbec benefited as a similar flavor profile in terms of color and density and weight at a $20 price point versus a $50 or $100 price point. You can see it in the numbers right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as everything, it's a question of timing and being in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely.
Here you can see in this chart that is price and volume, and you can see that it has kept, the prices also have sustained and has been able to go up as the volume went up. And I think this is probably the most important chart today, is about prices and what are the FOB prices from Argentina. And we can see that because of the economy, because of the difficulty of producing great quality wines at very low price in Argentina, they have moved to bulk, and the bulk has affected the range of $18 FOB, where we can see a loss of 38% in FOB and a 39% in volume. The next segment that has lost, but minimum, is the FOB from $18 to $29. 2.60 and 3.50 in dollars and volume. But strangely enough, in the category, in the price bracket from $29 FOB to $40 FOB, we have seen a growth of 12.80% in dollars, and we have seen a growth of 12.60% in volume. The same from 40 to 90, 5%, 550 in dollars, and 6.80 in volume, and on a case of $90 up, a 0.3% in dollars, but a 5.70% in price, in volume. I think this is very important because of the economy, we could say that we are only selling bulk wine and the category is suffering, but actually the people are going for the higher. Yes.
Is the price segment retail price, or is it the FOB?
This is FOB.
Give an idea, and yeah. It depends on what channels you go through, but $40 is give or take 10.
Yeah, $9.99.
In the U.S., and then $90, give or take 25.
Mm-hmm.
Retail price, to give you an idea.
One of the main reasons the stats are so negative in that lowest price point is because in California, we had very challenging vintages in 2010 and 2011. Massive yield loss. So the large wine companies, the publicly traded companies, and the Gallos of the world supplemented 15% plus of their production with Argentine wine. So they would bring it up in frozen bricks or in different scenarios, and they would supplement all of these massive brands that they produce with Argentine wine. As 12 came around, and it was a high-yielding vintage, and 13 will be as well, there is not as much need for
yes,
that.
There is a loss already in 2013 of 50% of the bulk wine exported to the U.S. And I had a meeting with the Board of Directors of Wines of Argentina last December, and I said, how can we integrate? How can we send the message in the U.S. that bulk wine that is coming can be pulled together with bottle wine coming so we can show the truth of the Argentine wine business in the U.S.? But still, besides that, it shows the strength of Argentine wines in other categories, in between the 18, 25, and up.
Nora.
Yeah.
I think it's worth pointing here that we are all in segment 4 and 5, right?
Yeah.
And our super premium wines are definitely in segment 5. Mm-hmm. And what I like of this, besides the fact that it's growing, is that it's a good percentage of the total.
Right.
So if you see segment 4, is the biggest in number. It's $140 million out of the total.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is an opportunity there. It wouldn't be important if the growth was 10 to 20%, but the number was very slow.
No, definitely.
So people drink the expensive Argentine wines.
Mm-hmm.
But the question would be, how does a $50 Argentine wine compare on the shelf with a California Cab or a French wine at the same price point?
You cannot compare like that because California will always win, because 70% of all the wine consumed in America is Californian. And if that $50 bottle of wine is a very well-known, reputable California winery, there is an affecto societatis immediately towards the California wine. If it's a French, I think that it all depends on the age of the buyer. If it's a young buyer, they don't know about French and French Bordeaux, French Burgundies, so they probably will not buy the French $50 if they're younger. But if it's an older consumer, they will appreciate what is a first growth or a second growth. What is interesting is that the Argentine wine that is sold at $50 will be pushed by the trade, by the owners of the liquor store. They will be talked about because they think that is a great price-quality ratio. They will say, you know what, you have to try this. So, trends in the U.S., wine industry, more wine is being sold in drugstores. That's not your business, but for you to know. Online wine sales are finally coming into their own. I saw in your presentation that you're exploring online sales too. I think that's a good way of tapping into consumers. Sweet spot, not for you, 10 and 15, but that's where the trend goes for mass consumers. Hottest varietals, Moscato, Malbec, and sweet red blends. Moscato, we are exporting Moscato, but I don't think it's our business and probably goes directly with a hose from the winery in Argentina to the winery in California who pumps it out. Argentina still has a very good image in spite of everything that is happening and that you know well because you are invested in Argentina. We get to have a very vibrant, positive image with the consumers and with the trade. And as I said, 70%, 30% of all the wine consumed in America is imported. Of that 30%, Italians own probably 30%. Then it's the Australians. Then we are fighting Chile, Argentina, France in volume, Chile sometimes wins over Argentina. Argentina always wins on value over Chile.
Not for long.
Well, because he just took a portfolio of Chilean wines.
Sorry, that was a little self-serving.
You got to believe in yourself.
Yes. So we wish you well.
I'm your seller.
We wish him well. This is the top 25 Argentine exporters to know who is who. But what I like about this is the FOBs. Esmeralda is Catena, Peñaflor is Trapiche, Trivento is Banfi, Conchitoro, Escorihuela is part of the Catena group, Norton. But you can see Dominio de Plata, Doña Paula, except Trapiche, that they're really fighting the lower end category. All of the FOBs are $40 and up. And this would be the last list of
you
all the.
You have pies of Mendoza in that list?
Oh, I'm sorry, not yet.
That's
it. Florida del Tupungato?
Chaval Ferrer.
I was finding, who is this guy? Who's this guy?
Look at that price.
So that's it.
I brought the wine for dinner.
Thank you.
Can you close it? Yes.
That's a great context. Let's dig in a little bit to the practice. Ed, you're an interesting perspective because you have a portfolio of a number of wines and sake also. But what you've learned, seen over the last, what's it been, 10 years?
Oh, now 14. So I have to tell a funny story before I give Michael that answer. So we started in 1999, having just run into Argentine wine by accident on a trip down there and met a bunch of people. And then one day, a guy named, we were just about to get started importing a few brands, a guy named Santiago Acheval showed up in my office at the time. Was about the size of just this area on Pier 19 before they redid it. And I have very few regrets in the wine business, but my probably biggest one is not taking Santiago's wine. Yeah, you got to have one mistake along the way. So thanks, Nora. That was a very good presentation. Again, I think a presentation like that really puts you in the mode of the main question you always have to keep answering for yourself is, this is the wine business, but what is my wine business? What am I trying to do? What are my wines' quality? What are my wines' price? Because generalizations in the wine business will always get you into trouble, and particularly if you're doing very specialized projects and making very high-quality wine. And so even something that Nora is correct, the millennials are driving a lot of consumption and even Malbec consumption, but almost nothing in the category we're talking about here, because these people are still living at home, they can't get jobs, they have very little buying power. And so, again, that was a good reminder that, yeah, in fact, your customers, depending on whether I don't know exactly, $20, $30, $40 wine, you're really talking about people like me. I mean, you talk about 40, 50-year-old, 55, 60-year-old people who have the buying power. And I think, again, my generation's been around long enough that they're quite experimental in quality. And again, as Nora pointed out, the nice thing about America versus Britain is that we are the great, you know, open-minded, we'll try anything as long as there's quality in it, and we'll come back to it. And the Brits, they're very guarded about experimenting.
And their price.
And I never quite understood them. Talk about Argentine wine doesn't really make any sense. Which is why America is selling a heck of a lot more Argentine wine than the UK, and the UK got a long head start on us. But, you know, I think when we came in, our first, there was very little Argentine wine market, as Nora said at the time. And our first, we had 12 wines to start. Our cheapest was $24 retail, which would probably be suicidal, I think, today. But this is in the late 90s. Things hadn't blown up yet in 01. In Argentina, and the dot-com boom was still going on. And so we were idealists, and we said, hey, you know, if the wine's in the bottle and the packaging's good you can get their story, the great stories that these people have, people will buy the wine. And that's still generally true today, even with the amazing amount of wine coming from Greece and all these other crazy places. There's room for quality at reasonable volumes from almost anybody. And so What I would say is, for those of you who are, make sure when you're thinking about your wine project, have a good fix on what the number of bottles or cases are going to be, and then start all your thinking from there. It's like, well, is this enough for me to drink and give away? Is this, do I have to really think about, well, geez, I dine out a lot, so if I can get 10 restaurants and a few retail stores in my area to carry it, will that be enough to keep the wine flowing every year? The good and bad of the wine business is you generally want to make wine every year if you can, if you're going to be serious about it. And so it has to go somewhere, and the French are experts at making wine before they figure out what they're going to do with it. And that's why they're in such trouble today, is that there's wine from everywhere now, that they can't move their wine, because I can't tell you how many people built wineries without a plan in France, and we're always like, what were you thinking? Or even French in Argentina, it's constant. What were you going to do with the wine?
Oh, we're going. We have 127 of those. So that would be my 122.
I was also pretty skeptical about Michael's plan when I first heard it, but that's what I would advise. Is you now have the chance to do it ahead of time and think about, okay, this is a great opportunity. I mean, to be able to grow your own grapes and make your own wine. I'm a partner also in a small winery up in Healdsburg, and it's a tough business as a standalone winery. It really is. But I think this, the services they can provide. I have like an LLC in Argentina. Wow, what a pain in the ass that is to do by yourself. These guys really bring it all together and take a lot of the hazards out of the business. But it's up to you to decide. I think, what is it? What's your vision? You have to have a vision for what you want to do.
That's a great point.
That would be my key suggestion.
Well, Paul, you've been in selling wines out of Napa for a long time. And then with us over the last 3 years or so, you really focused on what do we want to create? What is our winemaking plan for Recuerdo using the grapes of all our owners that they don't use? What have you found in the last few years of breaking into the Argentine?
It all comes down to me, huh? So all the grapes have to come back this way.
I'm kidding.
It takes time. Building brands takes time. And, we've been, selling in market for about 2 years now, and we're really starting to see the momentum. And that's one-at-a-time, relationship-based marketing. A lot of the stats you see up there are transaction-based scenarios where, the product gets scanned and it's gone. We're about relationships. We value systems like Salesforce to track everything that we do every day of the week by every one of our team members, with the media, with the clients, with the trade partners. You have to build those relationships. And, we're very well positioned with the brand Recuerdo, with the product, with the packaging, with the price positioning. It's all about the proper promotion with the brand now and getting people to really hear the story, because the story is dense. We have so much that we can pull from. There are many brands that are shallow. They really don't have a lot to talk about.
What do we focus on? Uco Valley is a big driver, right?
That's
probably our number one driver.
That's probably one of the most important things, so that we don't get the Shiraz syndrome in Argentina long term. You have to focus on sub-appellations. It's why Napa has the equity that it does in relation to its neighbors in Sonoma or the Central Coast or what have you. It's about the Uco Valley. And when you put that on the label, and I'll never forget the first distributor in New York that I presented Recuerdo to, without exaggeration, the first question that came up was, where's the wine from? It's a Uco Valley. Goes, why is it not on the front label? Why is it not on the front label? The next vintage, it was on the front label. You have to differentiate, because that appellation, that sub-appellation, creates price premium scenarios and allows, if you just look at the Uco Valley for the price positioning of the brands in relation to the competitive set that's out there, it's not even close. The Uco Valley has such prominence in terms of its pricing power.
We call it the Napa of Argentina.
Absolutely. And that's that's how we speak about it as well. In terms,
what you rate the prices of PVs? You call it hit the leg down in the United States?
I literally just came back from a trade show in New York about 2 hours ago. We saw about 2,000 people in Manhattan. And when people taste the Recuerdo wines, the style is spot on. I mean, it is spot on with the acid profiles and both the wines, the Torrontes and the Malbec. The packaging is beautiful. The price, it's well positioned. It's just about building those relationships. And when you go to a scenario like that, and you know, as was being alluded to, we all know it's a very difficult business. You've got to really spend your time creating those relationships. And at the end of the day, when you see a guy, this is my scenario yesterday, you haven't seen in 5 years, and he works with our distributor, Winebo, and I said, what are you doing for Winebo these days? Oh, I'm the national accounts director for Costco. How you been? What are you doing after? Because all I want to do is have that conversation. I want to understand, okay, what are you doing with Costco? Not necessarily saying I want my wine in there, because there's a lot of bad things with Costco.
But they're by far...
Costco is the number one buyer of wine in America, by far. And there's ways that they position wine in the right way that won't affect our price positioning. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's scenarios that, guess who the first guy I'll be calling tomorrow after giving him a 24-hour break? Check back in and find and build that relationship. So it's there, you know, with Recuerdo. In case you're not aware, you can go to the Recuerdo website. You can see all the states in which we're distributed. We're in over 30 U.S. states. Now we're in Canada. We're just brokering a scenario into the U.K. and a few other markets. So it takes time, but it all starts with you hopefully going out and asking in your restaurants, in your retail stores, do you carry Recuerdo? My brother is forced to do that. Because he's family, I ask that you do so as well, because that's where it all starts to create those relationships.
Sandy, you spent a lot of time on planes building those relationships.
I completely agree with Paul. It is.
Excuse me, Sandy. Can you stand up? I'm sorry. I'm just
so it is something that will separate your wine from the sea of wine out there. It's the forest of wine out there. And they're fantastic wines at all our price points. Even though my price points are good, I'm happy with them. Still, the thing that separates your wine from everybody else is that somebody remembers not only the flavors in the bottle, but the story. So my advice for you, those of you who are putting your toes into the water, thinking of going commercial, and still making one or two barrels for yourself, you need to have the relationships there before you make the wine. So start selling your own stash. Because if you build up the stash and then get the relationships, it becomes painful. When you see that wine going into inventory and not coming out, and suddenly something that was beautiful and was a pleasure becomes a headache. And you don't want that. So the restaurants you go to, build them, sell them from your own stash. Get those relationships going. Always, and one of the key things about our strategy as a winery is always build the perception, ideally the reality, but at least the perception of scarcity.
Absolutely.
That is, a guy wants 10 cases of your wine, and you have a warehouse with 2 pallets, and you tell him, I'm very sorry, I can only give you 3. And that's tough. That is not easy to do because you want the money, you need the cash flow. So work on the perception of allocation, of scarcity. The wines not only have to have the quality of the bottle paramount, because nobody's fooled by scarcity into buying something that is not worth the price. But once you have the quality of the bottle, and I'm so happy, just parenthesis, so happy with this project. You know how many vineyards in the world, 5 years after planting, that are comfortably making 92 and 93-point wines?
None.
None. None. We are in a very good place. Good choice of land, Michael.
You know, that's a key point. You know, the Reserva wine that will come out this fall from Recuerdo, you know, received 92 points from The Spectator, which, with young vines, that is definitely saying something. And what happened, we can see it immediately when that score is not actually in the public yet, it's in some private release channels. It has a halo effect that's pretty phenomenal. It's exactly why you produce a Reserva wine or a Grand Corte that we're working on. So it just trickles down into that $20 tier, which is the Recuerdo Malbec, and it pulls it through the market much more quickly. So we've already seen the positive effect of some of that.
I also would add, besides the story, the personal connection, that the sommelier can say, you know, Santiago was here yesterday, and he showed me this wine. I want you to try. Or I know the owner. I know the winemaker. So I would say start local.
But don't you buy wines like that? I mean, you know, those of you that have met Carmelo Patti, I mean, you'll buy his wines forever because you spend time with him in Santiago. I mean, people make those connections. There's a million wines. You need some reason to buy one or the other.
An affecto societatis between the bottle and the buyer.
I think we have a great opportunity here. We have in the room probably, we saw the categories from segment 1 to 5, the different prices. It's really, it gives me optimism that there is a big percentage of wines, Argentine wines sold in the United States is in the highest price point. So I think there is a big opportunity for us. But we saw the numbers. We have here the king of of that category. It, by far, it's amazing. I think the second, the other was Viña Cobos, that is Paul Hobbs, was half the average price you have in per case. So I think it would be nice to hear from you. How do you put yourself, your winery in that position?
I think it starts with the same goal we all have, and that's how much we have in common. Make insanely good wines. Make a wine that is fantastic. Because even though I sell a lot of wine at $20, $25, and many bottles, it is still only a third of my revenue. I make a third of my revenue at the $100 bottle level, and another third at the $50 bottle level. We did a strange strategy that is sort of normally commercial wineries do the entry level wine, and then they build on top of that, trying to create the hill effect, and they have the super premium wine in a few barrels. We did a top down. We did a pull down. We did the Fincas, and then we built Quimera, and then when the brand was there for containers of the Mendoza line, we created that wine 5 years after starting the winery. So when you're small...
Was it just quality or what else? What those connections we are talking about? How do you...
Quality first. Within quality, personality, uniqueness, originality, terroir. We have a great land. We can do that. Second, walk, pound the pavement, walk the streets, and create those relationships and find the people that love it. Ratings help a lot, too much in my perception. Once you have the brand, never complaining. Listen, I just got a couple of good scores from a spectator, and it's good to be there. And some of them are growing every year. You don't want that to be the all of your marketing campaign to be scores. You want, as Paul said again, relationships. A guy that you walk into the store and he remembers your face and knows about the wine and tells you how he pulled out a bottle of 2002 Quimera a week ago. That's the guy you want. So it's better a few customers that buy a lot, a modicum of your wine than a million of people that chase after your latest 95 score and just get a bottle. And the following year you get 94 and hey, what's wrong with you? You drop the ball. So
I would say, Santiago, that your winery at Chaval Ferrer was the first super premium boutique winery that came after Catena. Catena opened the flood and opened
blazed
the doors.
He blazed the trails.
Yes, but at Chaval was the first winery because of the personality, the style of your wines that were very distinctive, very unique, and that captured the imagination of the boutique geeks, the wine geeks, the sommeliers, etc.
Well, one of the things we'd need, it's a good moment to talk about it, is what is going on flavors and trends and styles in the U.S. And I think Uco Valley is very well placed to just get on horseback with that trend. It is less oak, less pretentiousness, more honesty, more freshness in the wines. I think Mariana can tell a lot about that too.
Yes. But let me say that when we talk about less oak, and this is important, it's less oak presence in the wine, like
less
on the flavors, or
more balance,
aromas.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's not using oak. Oak, when it is well used, is very beneficial, and you can get really the advantages of using a balanced oak presence in the wine, the tannins, the microoxygenation. So that is when we mean less oak, is basically that, okay? making sure that the oak choice is the correct one. Actually, this morning, actually with Richard, we were talking about making, having a complexity also, playing with that, with those elements, like in different type of fermentation.
It's about balance.
It's about the balance. You don't want, I always say this in the tastings, and you know me, so you know I always say this, but I don't want to have a glass of wine and just, I mean, it's nice because you feel, oh, look, it's coffee. Great, coffee. You pick it, you know, so you feel happy. But that is lack of complexity. You don't want a glass of wine that just smells of coffee. You want a glass that you put your nose, you fall in love, but you don't know what it is. It is, could be a spice, it could be fruit, it could be a blend of all that. That is the one when we talk about less oak is that, you know, that balance, that you want the fruit to be there. You don't want just oak, vanilla, coffee, high toast, okay? Unless you want that, it's for you, and then...
Well, there's this old saying that there are no over-oaked wines. They are under-fruited wines. A wine that tastes too much like oak is because somebody grabbed a $15 retail wine and decided to have a $35 retail and said, okay, I'll put this grape, same grapes, into New York. And that's a mistake. As Nora said, Maria said, it's all about balance. And the intensity of the fruit, and this drives my perennial mantra, is less fruit per vine. And it's the most painful decision you make because you drop a lot of money on the floor. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to make that insanely good wine, I know no other path than less fruit per vine. In a balanced fashion, doesn't mean that the more you drop, the better it gets. There's a curve there. There's a point of decreasing marginal returns. But it means that there's one market for full production at those $12 retail. There's another market for those 3 tons per acre at $25 retail. But if you want to break into the category of 50 and above, it is through low production. That is, you invest more in fruit. But if you do the numbers and you look at how much you're investing in fruit and how much an increase in the investment in fruit works through the final price, it's the best investment you can make. Because then you'll have a balance with your new oak, you'll have a fantastic wine, and the increase in price you can get, especially if you start going through different, not through the whole full three tiers, but more with a direct-to-consumer approach that you can do in your friendly restaurant or that kind of thing, then the investment in fruit really pays off. Because you get a memorable wine and memory, remembrance, recuerdo, is what you want to create brands. And you get a higher price point that more than fully justifies the sacrifice you've made up front.
Paul, we're thinking a lot about, we're trying to make the best possible wines for Recuerdo, but we're also... We're somewhat responsive to the market, right, in terms of the style of what we're trying to create. You want to talk a little bit about of what we're creating and our vision for the styles of wine?
The flavors. Well, as Itchin, I was going to say, we were at Pebble Beach Food and Wine earlier this spring, which was a great industry event, and we had a panel of Malbecs that Recuerdo got on, and Laura Catena was on the panel. She was there. And we had two masters of wine, which is a very rare education level for an individual to understand wine, and then a master sommelier in the panel. And there were 12 wines there. There were 4 Catena wines going back 15, 20 years. There were a couple other Argentine wines. There were some California. And what was interesting about Recuerdo, when you came around it, it had such a brightness and a freshness to it. It almost smelled more like Pinot Noir than a lot of these other brooding wines that were there. And I had the master of wine from 11 Madison Park in New York come up to me afterwards and said, this is stunning wine for how compatible it will be with food, which is exactly what a wine at this price point should be. It should be made to complement, not overwhelm. And he said, it's rare that you see Malbec, we're speaking specifically of Malbec, it's rare that you see Malbec have such color density, such weight and acid, you know, and still have kind of a feminine side to it. And that comes from the Uco Valley. That's from that, you know, diurnal shift from day to night. you know, same thing, we try and focus on in Napa and everything we're doing. And I think you're spot on with that style trend of everybody wanting to go more towards bright, fresh wines. A lot of the millennial generation doesn't understand oak, you know, like.
But I think the trend is true. Less oak, and as Marina said, it's not about not having oak, but the taste, the popular taste today, and it's not popular because it's populous,
right,
but it's about having the freshness, the acidity, the flavors. Everybody's looking for flavors.
Sure. Yeah, and back to style, it's sad but true, as Santiago was saying, if you live by your editorials, you will die by your editorials. If that's the core of your marketing, branding scenario, you got a problem. We appreciate them. We know they sell wine. When we're making the wine, I'm factoring in different people's palates. Robert Parker, Steven Tanzer, Steve Hymoff, James Labbe, all these guys. You're thinking about how they think about the wine. You have to. If you don't, you're not understanding part of your audience. You don't make the wine to them. You just think. And I know that Steven Tanzer should love Recuerdo because he loves acid in wines. He absolutely appreciates that style. So you're making it to the palate of the consumer, but you're understanding along the way who is going to influence that. And one thing to really mention about Argentina and Malbec, what's very different about it is this has all been consumer-driven. It's all consumer-driven. It's not trade-driven, the growth in Argentina, in my opinion. It's all people at the end trying to pull it down the pipeline. And a lot of the times you'll see the trade that will be reticent to do it. And they're like, no, we don't need that. But I want that, says the consumer in the restaurant, the retail store. And that is a good thing. You know, you just got to get certain people out of the way and make sure the bottle can get to market because there's demand on the other end. You know, some of these sommeliers, they want to serve more Grüner Veltliner than wines that people actually want. So there's an opportunity there. It's just creating those relationships and making sure they understand what we're producing. The Torrontes, for example, that we produce is stunning. I mean, that wine, if people put it in their mouth, is amazing, the Recuerdo Torrontes. That varietal has a very challenging position, partially because of the wine is so intense in its aromatics, in its floral components, that if you don't follow up with great acidity on the back end, kind of that almond skin or lemon peel, almost an Albarino quality, a Spanish white, you can fail. But when people put this wine in their mouth, they're pretty stunned. And like I say, just being in New York, watching people literally come from across the room to taste a $12 white wine, that's what you want.
The first supporter of Torrontes was Parker in 88, talking about a chart on this.
Yeah.
And sales spiked after that. I think that Ed, he's the first importer to start a whole separate portfolio of Salta wines with Torrontes.
Yeah, we outsell everybody by a mile on Torrontes, but we got into it early because we love the wine. I think I want to address, particularly for this crowd, what Paul was saying, because about critics and deciding what you're going to do with your wine, because Michael also mentioned, you know, what you have to have your own vision a little bit here. Look, Malbec is 68% of the wine, but that means that there's something else, 32% that is not Malbec, right? And so when you're talking, these are big numbers talking about big amounts of wine going through. So that will tell you that Malbec is popular, but if you're going to build something small and important and intense for yourself, and really when you're building relationships, like Santiago said, you need to be able to walk in and they look into your eyes, and when you're talking to them, they can see right into your soul that you mean everything you say. That's the best sales tool you can have. And to do that, you really have to be invested in the idea of why you made that wine. And that is not, while certainly Malbec, you can make great Malbec, obviously it's done on every vintage by some people here. But there are other great wines from Argentina. We actually sell less than 68% Malbec.
You're an expert on blends.
And we do a lot of blends. We're exploring what the price realms are of Tannat out of Salta. But again, the Yucco Valley, the beauty of the Yucco Valley is you can make great Cabernet Franc, you can make great Syrah, you can make great blends. And in many ways, I think some of the most stunning wines that we represent are blends from the Yucco Valley. And again, the nice thing about blends also is that it's not so easy for the trade or the consumer to put you in a box against a million other products that are right in front of them. Then you have the opportunity to tell them your story,
taste your wine. They can taste your wine without so many little data points trying to run around their head, and you really have a much better shot of going, yeah, the consumer going or the trade going, yeah, this experience all makes sense. I look at this bottle, I taste the wine, I hear the story. That is a $50 bottle of wine. And they don't have to be like, oh, yeah, I could get this for $40 from the Languedoc or some cockamamie thing because it's the same varietal. So it's something we debate all the time about, you know, what varietals to go to, how hard to stay with Malbec blends. There's no obvious answer, but we're trying to deal in larger volumes and on some wines, but also in smaller wines. But I think for your own project, if you're not familiar with a lot of other varietals, you should do some exploration before you get too deep into your vine selection of, well, what does Cabernet Franc taste like? There's some very good California Cabernet Francs. There's Cabernet Francs from France. California probably more similar. But see what these guys advise in terms of the range of red varieties that do well in the Yucca Valley, and then get to understand what those taste like. Because I think, again, at small volumes, I mean, I enjoy selling a lot of wine, believe me, but some days I wish I was selling just a little bit of wine because you can be much more specific about what you want to do.
And I agree, because if you're a small producer, you can get into having one variety or two, but a Cabernet Franc, and the Cabernet Franc is fabulous. You're going to find people, buyers that love, and they're going to follow.
You don't need a million customers.
No.
You just need enough.
Yeah.
We've been making Malbec and the blend with this lady's help and this gentleman's help. And we've run into a problem, which is that there's a large segment of people who associate blends with cheap wine. You know, they're not the sophisticated people, and they don't realize that Bordeaux and Châteauneuf du Pape and, you know, some of the great wines are blends. But so, we've sort of found that we have a pricing problem because the people that think of blends as being cheap wine, you know, are not going to pay the $39.
What's your current price attempt?
$39.
Yeah. And what's labeled as Malbec?
He has a Malbec and a blend.
Okay.
Yeah. A blend is, you know, you can't.
I think this is also.
But, you know, it's an education thing.
It's a challenge because it happened to me, even like some of you at the beginnings were really blends. And I think it's changing little by little.
You're
So, again, it's. Interestingly enough, your issue might be that you're.
We like blends. You're neither
high enough in price nor low enough in price. There was a time when you're right, red blends were simply, well, that's the kitchen sink and it all goes into the bulk products. I would say today that's changing even at the low end. The red blend market, and some of it's driven by sweet red wines, which everyone in this room should probably abhor if you don't already. but you have to walk in and you have to have complete confidence in the wine, and you have to make, obviously the packaging has to say, yeah, this is pretty expensive wine. Our most successful red blends are, you know, $40 and $50, and so in some cases you either don't have all the pieces necessarily all talking in the same volume, or you might want to try and make a little bit better wine and price it up. Strangely, is that
how many cases of Vin Marco do you sell?
Espressivo?
Yeah.
We'll probably do about 1,500 9-liter cases, and that runs about $35, and that's always been a blend. Mm-hmm. Now, Vin Marco also benefits from brand recognition at $20 for Malbec, so people have a sense of the wine. But we have things like Mendel Unis.
Mendel Unis is
a very, very good quality wine. Not that many people know about it, much to their chagrin and mine. And we do, you know, we're talking about a brand in the U.S. that probably does between the main varietals 4,000 or 5,000 cases. So this is an area, and these wines sell for $30, $50, $115 at the very top.
Well, that's Quimera for you, Santiago.
Quimera sells $50.
Yeah,
$45 to $55.
How does that wine sell?
It is tougher than I thought it would be. It's mainly because the people that are selling it find it easier to sell the Malbec than they find to sell the blends.
Sure.
They don't have to explain so much. It's different, but it's two sides of one same coin. If you walk into a store and you have a blend, you have 10 more minutes of face-to-face time explaining your blend, and those 10 minutes can be critical. Mm-hmm. So if it's you one-on-one doing the sales, then your blend will drive it, and I'd say, like Ed, price it up.
Yeah.
Price it up by a big chunk so that you have a statement in the price that this is an awesome wine. Mm-hmm. But when you go through the three tier and you have to go through the sales rep of a distributor,
yes,
then you get through the lazy people.
It's hard to tell the story.
They have a book. They don't sell. They take orders, and they don't tell the story. So in that case, the blends are more difficult than the straight malbec.
Yes, and if you have the contact directly to the retailer, like the restaurant, or you are going to make them taste the wine, make them taste it blind. Don't tell them. And then talk about them. In that way, you know, they won't have the preconception that they don't like the blends. You know, some people say, I don't like Cabernet Sauvignon. You make it taste blind, and I can assure you that sometimes they love it. So it is just a question of not letting them have that preconception as well.
Again, it also depends on volumes. I think you're relatively safe at 250 line liter cases of wine at $40 and $50. If you have the wine in the bottle, you can make it move.
Yeah.
I must say, we go through distributors, and so that is a challenge. And so we do find we hit a limit in the number of cases we can sell, even though of the highest quality, highest rated wines. We hit it before Santiago does, so we don't score quite as well. But yeah, when you know between 250 and 500 cases, after that, yeah, you have to be a genius for getting great scores or really outstanding scores. And there aren't too many examples of what Santiago does.
I sell roughly 3,000 cases, 9-liter cases of Chimera in the U.S.
Yeah, so that's...
Rich, do you have a question?
Yeah, Santiago, presumably you started at a lower price point on the Finca.
Yes.
And created a demand, and as the demand rose, the price rose.
Yes.
Such that there was a lockstep.
Well, there's also 15 years or 14 years, there's inflation even in the dollar that... many of those categories were grown, but yes, we started around $70 retail for the Fincas.
Started a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah.
At the time, was unique.
Yes.
Only Catena could do it.
So my question, which would also I'd like to hear Ed's view on it, is if someone wanted to make an ultra premium wine, what would be the best strategy to pursue that? Would it be to start at a lower price point, a much lower price point, and try to build demand and raise it? Or, Ed, you just mentioned, you know, that this gentleman should raise his price to make, or Santiago, you want to make a statement. So I'm curious as to what your views would be on it.
These guys can talk better than I can, but I think raising prices, you can do it within certain... price points, tranche.
It's really hard to make big gaps.
You can't make a $25 bottle of wine and then raise it up to 100. It's impossible. You leave behind all your first consumers, and you have to make new ones on the road.
Yes.
You can take it from $70 to 100, yes, because you're still working in the same zone, but not from 25 to 100.
Truly the most important question to ask is, who's your end customer? And what's the channel to get there? And that'll dictate your pricing strategy.
And how many of them you need.
Yeah, truly. Are you on-premise? Are you off-premise? Do you have to go through a distributor? Are you going to sell it all direct online? That's going to dictate how we think about it.
And price-quality ratio.
Yes.
You have to taste your wines against the competition in the market, against Chilean, against California, and against Spanish, French, so as to know where you are. Because your buyer has tasted those wines, and he knows where your wine is.
Yeah, it's possible to make a $70 wine and sell this much. There's no natural curve of, you know, everything sells a little bit. When you get to those prices, $50, $70, the consumer probably knows less than the trade at that point, because the trade gets to taste much more, but even those consumers aren't stupid. They know when the wine's in the bottle or not, and those people are probably drinking
wines from other places that they have a good gauge of what is a $50 wine, what is a $70 wine. Not true at the lower price points. So it's very hard to determine between $12 and $18 by the average consumer. But the people who pay attention and spend that much money,
and
the wine
taste.
Will be there.
And taste. If we look at Argentina, in Argentina they don't have the opportunity, Argentine producers, to taste competition. Here in America, every day, a retail or a restaurant receives at least 10 people, 10 producers coming to taste with him their wines. So they develop a palate.
I'd like to add, a lot of that is, this is discouraging because reality check. I'd like to add one note that is optimistic here. I sell out in three, four months of the fincas, the retail around 100. I sell 2,000 9-liter cases in the U.S. of those. And I have tasted the vines, not many, but I have tasted a couple of wines that taste as amazing as the fincas.
Can you sell those for us, please?
my lips are sealed.
Sure.
You know, but so we're talking about putting in the bottle, the vines, and as your vines age, we can make wines that will be selling up there,
yeah.
But slowly.
Absolutely.
Slowly. Mm-hmm. Impress first.
Price points on your Recuerdo.
On Recuerdo?
Yeah.
The Torrontes is 12. The Malbec's 22. The Reserva will be 35. And the Grand Corte will be 100. And that, like I say, that $100 bottle of wine will be a halo wine that we'll make very little of. It'll comprise less than 5% of our total production, but it'll hopefully serve as a beacon to the quality of the brand. You know, one thing I would say, for those of you that haven't been in a products business previously, consumer packaged goods, a rudimentary exercise is just go look at the 7 P's of product marketing. Seriously, start there. It's how I run every meeting that we hold in the company. Look at the 7 P's of marketing and understand where you want to be. That will help drive every decision you're going to make.
Let me just finish this gentleman's question because... again, it's related to the question of whether you go from a, start at 100 and maybe work your way down, or start at 70, work your way up. Really, it depends on how many cases you want to end up selling, and whether it's you want to continue growing or you have a kind of a stopping point. Halo brands are a little the strategy that Santiago used is on the face of it a little riskier, but really lends itself to a much longer growth curve if you make it work. So, but I'm going to grow a little bit, and I want to get to here, I'm going to stop. There are strategies, and this is kind of more of a Napa strategy, where you get to there, and then hopefully if you build a great brand and reputation, then you really truly have enough demand that you keep raising the price. We represent a California winery called Llewellyn. They make, 800 cases a year, beautiful wine. We get about 400 cases. These guys never want to raise price. We forced them to raise price 3 times because we sell out in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. They sell out in hours. Their waiting list is like this long. They're like, guys, you're making more people angry than you are happy at this point. So you can use price to really get the old supply and demand curve where you want it if you're really truly interested in stopping at a certain number of cases.
Yes, and I think that it's a bit risky sometimes to say, nobody knows me, so I will start with a $20 wine, knowing that it's a $45 wine.
Never do
that. It's not advisable, never. Because then when you are going to ask for the real price that your wine is, people will say, no, I used to pay $20, I'm not going to pay $45. Yeah. So I always say this when you ask me for suggested prices, and really start where you want to be, and then when you grow, you grow upwards or down, like he did. Like, he started with the fincas, and then he started with Quimera and then Mendoza. Well, if you are there, then maybe you might have a top wine afterwards, or this is your top wine, and then you develop the other brands underneath. But like, having a jump of $20, for me, it's not advisable.
Never play with prices. The consumer knows very well the trade is unforgiving. They will drop you in a nanosecond.
And especially with the volume that actually we are managing with most of you.
Well, it's about time to actually drink some wine, but we've got one or two final questions that Nicole wants to delay our wine drinking a little bit.
Nora, in your slides you showed that there was some growth in online, and I just, with the people who are here, what are some insights and learnings in online sales?
Or any direct online, or any direct, I think.
Yeah.
If you wanted to sell your own wine online?
Yeah, I mean, what have been some of the learnings, you know, your slide mentioned that there was some growth.
It's very hard. I think as a small producers, when you have the visitor center, I think now there is there are companies that can ship directly to your to the people that visit the winery and taste your wines, and then you can sell the wine directly, and that's it, to buy to build loyalty.
The higher the price, the more you can sell online.
Yeah.
I'd say
commodity wine does not sell online. It sells in grocery stores and drug stores, etc. People won't wait
$10. The shipping costs more for Torontes than it does.
They won't wait for a $15 Chardonnay. It's not like that. Amazon has tried for 5 years to figure out the wine business. Amazon.
And they went through a lot of managers to do that.
Company, and they're in it now. They keep coming clawing themselves back at it. But it's you got to sell premium products online.
Harder to find things that are unique.
There's a lot of retail outlets that are only online that never has that never have a storefront.
And this gets back to the other thing. It's relationships and volume. If you've got 300 bottles and you've got a bunch of friends and contacts, and you tell your story to their friends. I mean, some people, Mike and Caprice, Barry sold a lot of wine through through his website, and it's relationships, and it's a delivering good price-quality ratio. It's the same stuff. You know, but he's not selling 100,000 bottles, but in reasonable length, so you can build it up, and people, there's scarcity. I mean, you've sold out every vintage.
My first vintage. just to level set, I met everyone in 2006, 4 days after they opened the tasting room. Okay, so that's where it comes from. Everything you heard them say is absolutely true. Everything they've said is absolutely true. Not because they said it. I've experienced it. Everything they said, I hear them say something after I've experienced it. It just gets reinforced. The whole concept. It's all about relationships, absolutely. All about relationships. You can sell all you want to all your friends and their friends and their friends of friends and friends of friends. My new boss bought a case of wine for me just because I talked to him about it, and a salesperson I work with bought 2 cases of wine for me just because I talked to him about it. So you do that kind of stuff. And then relevant, I wanted to make the one point about the packaging and the Porta. So I have a Porta, and it's my most expensive wine, and all the issues that you brought up are absolutely true. So what did I do? I wasn't smart enough to know. I just kind of, I don't know, I stumbled on it. The packaging's different. So everybody thinks it's better. It's just, what's the packaging? Used to the packaging? You're absolutely right. It was the packaging. No one has ever asked me, oh, it's a blend that should be cheaper. And 3 years, no one's ever said that. I was shocked when you said what you said, because no one's ever said it. Maybe it was just the packaging. I don't know.
That's where the women buyers
go. Going back to online. Sorry, I'd like to make a comment on online. Going back to online, as Barry said, it's just another way to sell to the people who saw your eyes sometime. Or saw somebody's
eyes. You're not going to place a banner ad there.
Or tasted the wine.
It's a delivery mechanism, it's not a sales mechanism.
Right. Yeah. And it goes slowly. It is very useful because you avoid all the intermediate steps. It should be the mantra, the ultimate goal of everybody in this room, to sell everything direct. Sorry.
No, I'm a small winery. I know the difference.
Direct builds wholesale. Wholesale builds direct. Yeah. They work together.
I think that trusting that you have a great wine is the first thing. You know, it's like not being afraid of saying, "Oh, I have this wine." Like, no, you have a great wine.
Be patient.
Okay, so you're going to give this great wine to a friend, to someone that you know. But I think that is having confidence of what you are making, and believe me, it's a great wine.
Well, let's try some of these great wines. Well, thank you all very much for the.